The following presentation was recorded at the Newbury Buddhist Monastery, Victoria, Australia. Please visit our website at nbm.org.au.
So, my name, as announced before by Chintai Sunyo, I think a little bit of an introduction is in order because I think most of you have never, may not have seen me before. Because this is my first time being here in Victoria, first time in Newbury Monastery, and also first time Dhamma talk for the Buddhist Society of Victoria. And yeah, unfortunately, as you all are very aware of right now, you're looking at this on your computer screen and not seeing this live because, yeah, we are still in a semi lockdown situation here in Victoria, and maybe later on I can come in to the city center. But so welcome to all those who usually come to the city center, but also welcome to everybody else who is watching these videos now, because of course great thing with the internet is now everybody can tune in, and you don't have to live in Melbourne and come to the city center to be able to enjoy these talks by the monks and nuns. You can also watch them from anywhere in the world, probably people from Europe are maybe watching, or maybe from America. So to everybody, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, or good night, whatever it is to you. May you have a lovely day. So my name, yeah, as I said, is Sunyo. I'm from the Netherlands, where I was born near the city of Rotterdam, and I lived there my whole youth. I spent in Rotterdam or near Rotterdam, and studied in Delft, but still living in Rotterdam, traveling to university from Rotterdam. And in when I was a younger boy, about 16, 17, I had a little bit of trouble with falling asleep because I was always thinking so much, thinking all sorts of thoughts about, well, whatever 16-year-old boys think of, you know, about school and about your friends and all sorts of, I was just thinking a lot of unnecessary thoughts, you know. And so I realized, why am I thinking so much? I shouldn't not be thinking so much when I'm trying to fall asleep. Is there anything I can do to think less? And I recalled that when I was younger, a little boy, I had this cool magazine that my parents bought me every month, and it was always about sharks and monster trucks and digging and factories and all that kind of cool stuff that boys love. I know I once gave a talk about fuel trucks in primary school. That's how interested I was in those kind of things. And I, at that time, I could look at a fuel truck and I look at the number plate and I would know what kind of chemical it was transporting, like a gas or some kind of whatever chemicals they take, because you can tell by the number plate on the back, at least in the Netherlands anyway, you can tell what's in there. So in case there's an accident, they can know. But anyway, that's how I was interested in those kind of things as a little boy. And but one time in this magazine, there was a little article, not about sharks or dinosaurs or monster trucks. No, this time was about meditation. Must have been some of the editors or something, was it? Was maybe a meditator and thought, let's put this in there in this little book, in this magazine. I don't know why they did it, and because when I read it, I was not interested at all as a little 12-year-old or whatever. But thank that person so much for putting that in there, that about meditation, because I remember reading it very briefly as a 12-year-old, but later I recalled it when I was about 16, 17-year-old, I recalled it. And I tried finding the magazine back again because I kept the whole collection. But I could not find the article again. But I recall a little bit about it, about meditation, and it being about being peaceful, and that there was a little bit about businessmen doing meditation 5 minutes a day just to clear their minds, and there was also other things about meditation. So I decided to try a bit of meditation to see if that would help me with falling asleep, with thinking less. So that was my real aim, just to think less, fall asleep easier. So I just started without any instructions whatsoever, just started meditating by myself. And didn't really know what I was doing. And that's actually a very interesting way to learn meditation, just to sit and see what you can think of yourself, you know. It's like it's like an experiment, basically, because sometimes you get so many teachings these days online, and at that time I didn't have internet yet, and so it didn't have so much teachings. And actually, that's a very, in a way, it's very helpful way to approach meditation and the Dhamma, because you can hear so much these days. Yeah, you've got all the, as I said, you've got all these recorded talks, you've got the things on the YouTube, and there's this Buddhist society and that Buddhist society, this monk, that monk, and you've got all the suttas, all the texts by the Buddha. You can get them all now online, and it's so much less effort than it used to be. In days past, even be lucky to stumble across a book, even. If you don't have so much information, it also, in a way, it's freeing, because you don't have all these different ideas in your head about what to do in meditation. There are so many different teachers, as I say, and so many different instructions, and it can be a bit confusing, or it can be, if it's not confusing, then at least it can create sort of expectations when teachers give certain instructions and they say, this is what you can do and this is what you can expect, and you this creates expectations for yourself. And so for me, it was very helpful in the beginning, not have any expectations, not have any instructions at all, and just see what happens, basically. But it was a useful experience, but I'm happy it didn't last for too long. Because quickly I also realized, okay, maybe I should get some sort of an instruction on meditation if this is going to be of any long-lasting benefit for me. What I did then is, a little bit later, I got the internet went on the internet and typed, I don't know what I typed, meditation or something, peaceful or meditation, not thinking or whatever. One of the first things I found, one or two things that were about meditation, that actually meditation with noting the thoughts and whatever. And I thought noting thoughts is just more thinking, so I didn't want to do that. So I searched a little bit, and then I very quickly, after maybe a first day of searching already, I came across Ajahn Brahm. Is this monk, Ajahn Brahm. You will all probably, people listening to this will know Ajahn Brahm. So Ajahn Brahm is my teacher. I ordained under him. But when I first saw him on the internet, I thought, who is this silly man with his silly clothes and the bald head? And even I thought that Buddha statue behind him, it looks a bit too auspicious or spiritual, I don't know how, because I was very atheistic and non-religious at the time, but I just wanted to know how to meditate. But he seemed to have this kind of an interesting aura or whatever, you know. It's something about me attracted him. I must admit, I was always sort of inspired in a way by monks as a young kid already. But so Ajahn Brahm, although I found him at the beginning a bit too much, maybe let's put it that way, I was inspired by his meditation teachings, because they were very relatable, very, I just thought, oh, when I heard them at first, I thought, this makes sense, and this is what I want to practice. So his meditation teachings are much about kindness and acceptance, and not thinking too much, just being in the present moment. And he's not the only one who teaches like that, but it's just the one that I happened to stumble upon. And yeah, well, years later, you see where it ended up, where I ended up. I ended up looking just as funny as him, basically, with the robes on, sitting in front of a Buddha statue, giving meditation talks. It was sort of, I don't want to compare myself to anybody, but sort of doing the same thing in a way. So yeah, it's, of course, there's lots of many years when between I first saw Ajahn Brahm's teachings on the internet and now. Yeah, I started meditating maybe when I was 17, but it hasn't been something that I always kept up. There were like periods that I didn't meditate at all, and then I would pick it up again. Then I would get too involved with girls, and then I would drop it again as a young boy, you know what it's like. And but in the end, that was the main thing. I always picked it back up again, and it became more and more an important part of my life, especially when I was nearing the end of university, after I finished my bachelor degrees, and I had some more time for myself, and I still was doing my master's degree, but I lived by myself at that time, no longer with my girlfriend, so I had more time to meditate, more time to invest in the spiritual practice, and met more new friends who were also Buddhists. They were from this little lovely group from Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, and we met every week and meditated together. And that was just such a lovely time in my life. I really look back to that with so much gratitude. And this is because this is also really the time that my meditation started flourishing more and really started to give more the kind of benefits that are beyond just being able to sleep better, because I fixed that problem very quickly, to not being able to sleep very well. With meditation, I was just relaxing a bit more, and that got solved pretty easily. And just have some nice peaceful meditation. But later on, yeah, the meditation becomes much more deeper and much much more powerful, and really something so big you can't ignore. It just becomes the main thing in your life, because it's it's like the main events in your life come from your meditation. Let me put it that way. And when that happens, then there's a little you can escape from becoming a monk or nun. So that's what I did. I was almost say there's almost no choice in the matter anymore. I like this concept that they have in Christianity. Monks or nuns in Christianity, they say sometimes it's a calling from God that they had to become a monk or a nun. It wasn't up to them, and it feels like to that. It feels like that to me as well. Not a calling from God, but a calling from whatever you would call it, the Dhamma or the Buddha or whatever, the Triple Gem. Just something I couldn't avoid. So even maybe if part of me didn't want to become a monk, I had to do it anyway. And that is 7 years ago now that I ordained as a monk, 6-7 years. This is my sixth range as a monk. So range is like when we take a 3-month-long retreat. And before that also, I was 2 years already in Bodhinyana as a novice and as a layperson, Bodhinyana Monastery. So it's been a long time now already, fully invested in the spiritual life. And it's been a good time. And but it's not just about having a good time. That's not what spiritual life is about. So I want to talk today a little bit about we live this life, spiritual life, either as a monk or a lay person, as a nun or a female lay person. Because when I walked in here to give this talk, I asked the Venerable here, something I asked, what should I talk about? Because I didn't have a clue what to talk about. I felt very uninspired this morning, I can admit. And I asked, oh, what should I talk about? And she said, talk about nothing. Ah, oh. I said, okay, I'll talk about nothing. That's what Buddhism is all about anyway. Actually, I think she was just, well, she was sort of hinting at that, like joking, like nothing is like the highest aim in Buddhism. So that is really why we meditate, really. Not just, as I said, not just to be peaceful and calm and kind, which are very important things, but the higher purpose of Buddhism is to what they call attain nibbana. Nibbana means like quenching of a flame going out. And what does that mean, really? It's hard to understand. Really hard to understand. Well, intellectually, it is understandable, easy enough. But to understand it on a more deeper and spiritual level, that is quite rare, and it's hard for people to understand, and even hard to accept on a more basic level. Because in many religions, they have a goal of the final goal of that religions is to go to heaven or Valhalla or unity with God or what have you. Even in Hinduism, they have got like the being supreme oneness or whatever, all these ideas, all these kind of experiences that you can have if you complete a certain religion. If you live your life as a perfect Christian, you will end up with God. If you live your life as a perfect Muslim, you'll end up in the Valhalla. Is that the Muslim thing? I think so. And if you have a perfect Hindu, you're oneness with the universe or the supreme self or whatever. But in Buddhism, what do you get for all your trouble, all your strife, all your hard meditation, your hard work, your ordination as a monk or a nun, or all your dana as a lay person, or all your trouble in the spiritual life? What do you get? Nothing at all. Nothing. Nothing at all. And that is just so amazing. Then you read here the Metta Sutta. I just have it here actually printed out. I don't really need the print, but you know. It says the last line. Kamesu vinaya gedang nahijata gabaseyang punareti. That means, being freed from sense desire, you're not born again in the world. That is going to heaven. But that is not the final goal of the sutta. Of the Buddhism, yeah? So this Metta Sutta is still limited in that aspect, that it only brings you to reborn in heaven. But the goal, eventually, of Buddhism is to not be reborn at all, to end the whole process of being reborn again and again, having then this life, then that life. Some lives may be very nice, like some lives you may end up being very healthy and maybe being very prosperous and happy. Other lives not so well, maybe. But in the end, the best thing is not to aim for the good lives, but to end the whole journey altogether, the journey through samsara. And then you end up with just fading away, extinguishment, cessation of experience, really. There's no experience left at all. This is what the Buddha kept talking about. You read the suttas and the word for cessation is always there. It's so enormously common in Nirodha is the word. So the Buddha always talks about cessation of life, bhava nirodha, cessation of existence, is the final aim of Buddhism, and that is a very peaceful aim in the end, because when I was younger and I reflected on all these religions and their goals, and as I just told you about, when I first got into Buddhism, it was just the meditation that I was interested in, and I didn't want to know anything of this, all this more religious kind of stuff. I wasn't interested at all, and because I was so non-religious myself and very atheistic, and I thought science knew it all. Yeah. At the time, that's what I thought. So I didn't want to know anything about this. But later, when I listened to more talks about meditation by Ajahn Brahm and other monks, then they also drop in some more deeper spiritual stuff from time to time as well. So I got slowly more interested in that as well. So I started thinking about this, about the goals of different religions. And even some of these religions have ideas of eternal conscious mind or whatever. In Hinduism, this exists. And I thought of that. That would be, what would it be like? Eternal consciousness mind. I think, I don't know about other people, but I think I would get pretty bored pretty quickly with being eternal conscious mind. I'm kidding, of course, but the basic idea didn't make much sense to me. But then, one day, I read the Four Noble Truths by the Buddha. I remember still the first time I read the Four Noble Truths on some sort of obscure website. I tried finding it again, couldn't find it, but this must have been a really well-translated website, because I got the gist of it straight away, at least on an intellectual level, about the Four Noble Truths, about the first noble truth, life, existence, being suffering, not just life as a human being, but life in any realm, being suffering, yeah? Even the life of some sort of super conscious being, if that, whatever that might be, would in the end be suffering, would not be satisfying, it would be, it couldn't last. Nothing can last, and therefore nothing is ultimately satisfying. That's the first noble truth. The second noble truth is that we get reborn in all these lives because we want to, basically. The craving for existence is the cause of suffering. Yeah, and that, can't recall the Pali exactly, but the craving that leads to rebirth, that is the cause of suffering. And the third noble truth, if you don't have that craving, you don't get reborn, and then suffering will end. And then the fourth noble truth about the practice, the path of practice. But it just made sense to me that in a weird way, this is such a weird goal of a religion. I always thought, before I ever saw this, I thought all these religions, they make up all these things about afterlives and rebirth, just to make the followers feel a bit better, you know? Just so they are not afraid to die. That's what I thought as a foolish young man. I thought of Buddhists, they just make up rebirth so that when their loved ones die, or when they are about to die, they're not so afraid, you know. They think, oh, there'll be an afterlife. So it's just comforting to them, the idea of rebirth. That's what I thought. But then you hear these noble truths, and then you realize that what the Buddha was saying is the actually exact opposite. Rebirth is not the comforting. Rebirth is the problem. And then when I read that, and then the third noble truth, that the ending of rebirth, so the ending of existence, that is what the Buddha's goal is. I remember laughing out loud, like, this is really something else. This is not comparable to any other religion, really. Like all the other religions, they aim for some more higher state of existence, really, whether it be in heaven or a union with the universe or whatever. It's always some higher state of existence, the super consciousness, the supreme self, whatever they have. But in Buddhism, it's not about creating a higher state of existence. It's about ending all existence. And when I first, I've got a smile on my face right now recalling when I first read it, I thought it was, I still didn't believe in rebirth, but I thought at least at the time, I didn't believe in rebirth, but I thought at least intellectually that is a really nice concept, you know, with the rebirth being the process of suffering, and then the goal is not just to create better experience, but to end it. And I really appreciated that intellectually at that point, and later I came to appreciate it much more on a deeper level as well, which is of course made obvious by the fact that I am now in robes and have really dedicated my life to these noble truths. And then I dedicate my life to the pursuit of ending life. So it's a weird thing, but it's cool, isn't it? It's cool that to not live your life to attain more things, to attain more bliss states, but instead to live your life to get nothing out of it, to end up with zilch, zero, nada. That, and I just like that idea. My favorite fairy tale that I have ever read. It's by the Brothers Grimm, who wrote all these other fairy tales, also about Little Red Riding Hood and all these other very famous ones. They wrote them down. I don't think they made them all up, but there is this much less famous one, which is just so funny, and it's called Happy Hans, or sometimes Lucky Hans, I think, also translated. And this is the story of Happy Hans. Happy Hans was a very hard worker. He worked for a farmer for 7 years, plowing the fields, sowing the seeds, and then gathering the crops, and then again plowing the fields, sowing the seeds, gathering the crops, plowing the fields, sowing the seeds, gathering the crops. For 7 years he did that, working so hard. And at the end of 7 years, he went to his boss, the farmer, and said, "I think I will retire from work and go home to visit my mother. Please, can you give me whatever I deserve for this hard work?" And the farmer said, "Well, Hans, you've been working very hard for me. So here is a big lump of gold for you to carry and bring to your mother." And he brought this huge lump of gold, as big as a head, as big as Hans's head. And Hans took it under his arm and set off walking on the journey home to his mother. And he was walking on the road with this big lump of gold, but of course very quickly he got really tired. This huge lump of gold was just weighing him down. It wasn't doing him any good whatsoever. It's just making him more exhausted. So then one day Hans came across another man on the road, and this man had a horse. And Hans thought for a moment, I said, and thought, "I could use a horse. That would make my travel so much more easy. I can just sit on the back of the horse and it will ride me, and I don't have to walk so much with this big lump of gold. Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. So Hans went up to the man and asked, "Can I buy that horse from you for this lump of gold?" And the man agreed. And Hans bought the horse for a lump of gold. And he was traveling along the road with this horse. Much more easy than with a lump of gold under his arm. But the horse was a bad horse. And it was always trying to throw Hans off his back. And it was biting him and kicking him when Hans wasn't looking. And Hans got a lot of scrapes and pains because of that horse. And then Hans thought, this horse, I don't have to carry it around under my arm like a lump of gold, but it's still no good. It's giving me much more trouble than I wish for. And then one day, Hans, walking along on the road on the back of his horse, came across this lady who was walking a cow across the road. And Hans thought, maybe I can get rid of this horse and get a cow. A cow is much better than a horse. A cow, they don't throw you off their back. They are much more gentle. They don't bite or kick. And what, I can get some milk from the cow, yeah, and then I have something to drink as well, because I'm getting really quite thirsty here traveling on the road. So Hans went to the lady and asked, can I maybe trade a cow for a horse? And of course, a horse much more expensive than a cow generally. So yeah, the lady happily agreed and gave the cow to Hans. And Hans, walking across the road with the cow, happy. But soon he found out the cow was actually dry, didn't give any milk at all, and was always slowing him down because he didn't walk fast, always needed a place with grass for the night to have something to eat. And the cow was much more trouble than it was for Hans. Didn't bring him any good. And Hans very sad about the cow now. Wow, now I don't get anything out of this. I'm just dragging it along. Then he came across a man with a pig. You know, the story can continue forever, which is the sort of the moral. Yeah, it's like samsara, continues forever. Yeah, it's always so. You think of something better, better, better. It's just like Hans. He came across a man with a pig, and he said, "Can I not get that pig from you in trade for this cow? And then I have a pig. I can. It doesn't need to." Stop for grass every time, because a pig can just eat whatever I give it. It eats anything. And then when I get hungry, maybe I can kill this pig and I have some bacon. Well, he was not a very good Buddhist, Hans, I don't think, because we don't kill animals. I don't eat meat or dairy anyway myself. But Hans, this is how the story goes. Yeah, so Hans decided to kill the pig whenever he got the chance and just have some bacon. But before he had the chance, there came another person and he said, I see you walking around with a pig, but in the next village, there is a story that somebody stole a pig. So if you go into that village, they will surely arrest you. So quickly get rid of that pig. And you know what? You can change it for this goose that I have. And the goose will give you some eggs that you can sell or eat. And you can also get the feathers and make into a nice soft pillow. Yeah. And Hans thought, a nice soft pillow is much better than all this other stuff I've been doing. Okay, I'll get the goose. And he had the goose instead of the pig now. And then he walked into the village. And there he saw a man with a grindstone and a grinding scissors and knives. And he asked the man, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm grinding knives and scissors for a living. I just have this stone, a simple stone, and I grind scissors and knives and people give me money for it, and that's how I make a living. It's very nice and easy. Wow, thought Hans, that looks very nice and simple. And he asked the man, can you get me maybe one grindstone as well, and I'll change it for this goose. And the man said, sure I can, but he didn't actually have another grindstone, so he just went somewhere and took a fake stone, coarse stone, and gave to Hans in exchange for the goose. And the stone was as large as Hans's head and very heavy to carry. But Hans changed it for the goose. And he thought, ah, this is so nice, just having this grindstone. It's all I really need. And now I can live a simple life, just grinding people's scissors and people's knives and make a living out of that. So he decided, he was very getting close to home, close to his mother, decided to spend one more night near the river. And he put up his stone next to him, near the river, and decided to get something to drink from the river. But when he did so, he bumped the stone, and the stone fell, and plump, in the river, and down the stone went. And Hans had nothing. Nothing left, he thought. 7 years I worked, and then I got a big lump of gold for it. For that I got a horse. And for the horse I got a cow. For the cow, a pig, and a pig, a goose. And for the goose all I got was this stone. And for the stone all I got was nothing. But I've never been so happy in my life, thought Hans. Because now I don't have to carry around anything heavy. I don't have to take care of these animals that bite me and kick me and don't give me anything good. Now I have nothing, and now I am truly happy Hans. So Hans went to his mother and was very happy after with having nothing to show for all his hard work. And that is the end of the story. And isn't that such a lovely story, that Hans goes through all his hard work, 7 years of hard labor, and then through experience he finds that the best payment he could have gotten for all his hard labor was actually just to have nothing, have zero. Because if you're happy with nothing, then whatever life gives you, it's okay. This is the purpose of Buddhism, is to we do all this Eightfold Path. It's like hard work in a way. Yeah, it's not always easy, the Buddhist path. And meditation can sometimes be hard. Renouncing things can be hard. Following the precepts, not always easy. So in a sense, it's hard work, the Eightfold Path. People coming to the monastery, supporting the monks and nuns, not easy, very hard. The monks and nuns doing their practice, living their life of lots of solitude. Yeah, we are now sort of Victoria's is in a semi-lockdown quarantine, but the monks and nuns, we are also in a lockdown in of a sense, a self-induced lockdown quarantine, because we are now the 3 months range retreat, which is 3 months that we don't travel anywhere, and we have this commitment to stay same place 3 months and spend a lot of time by ourselves. Just have the one meal a day is what I do, and spend a lot of time in my hut and not getting too involved in work or conversations. And this is also something not always easy to do. Usually it comes very easily for me, actually. Solitude, I really love it, and It also sounds, oh, not doing much work is that is actually easy, but sometimes actually it's the opposite. You get sometimes so much free time or so much time to meditate that you actually want to do something. You want to work more. I haven't reached that point yet because the rains has just begun. But from my experience from previous rains in Bodhiyana Monastery, I don't know how it's going to go here, is that it's at some rains, at some point, I get quite restless, actually. And then you find out it's actually quite hard to spend 3 months doing nothing. And 3 months, it is it's nice. It's also a commitment, not always easy. And just like Hans had to do a lot of hard work, which was not always easy. But in the end, it got nothing for it. This is also in Buddhism. You get nothing, really. The highest goal is to get nothing. You get a lot of happiness in between, before you get to the end. As the Buddha said, God is teaching good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. So in the middle is when you get the most of all the happiness. At the beginning, and in the end it's good because you realize the highest happiness. Just like Hans realized that the best way to travel is to just carry nothing around. Then in the end, in Buddhism, you also realize that the easiest way to be is what I was going to say. But you don't, not even being in the end is for life to cease. And this sounds intellectually maybe abstract or uninspiring, but this is when the practice of meditation comes in and shows you the path and shows you that this is the truth. And how can you do this? Because it's all nice and all that there is this monk here talking to you and laughing about nothingness and how he enjoys it. But how can you yourself realize the truth of these teachings and not just to rely on me or whoever else is going to teach you about this? And the truth to realize it by yourself is through meditation. In meditation, I love this quote by Ajahn Chah, which Ajahn Ram often repeats, which is, don't meditate to get things, meditate to get rid of things. So when you meditate, don't try to achieve any sort of states of bliss or mindfulness or whatever people tell about. Meditate instead to get rid of things, to reduce your sense of ownership, your sense of self, your sense of being. And when your meditation becomes more peaceful, you might realize it becomes more peaceful because things are starting to disappear. Things are starting to cease. I started meditating to get the thoughts, the thinking process to cease. And that was actually, I was quite successful at that, but I didn't realize at the time that's actually still quite superficial. That when the thinking ceases, it's sort of step one, you could say, of the meditation process. And I don't think of it too much in terms of steps or stages, because it just creates also ideas and goals again. But there's a gradual process of things ceasing. Generally goes like that, that thoughts cease first and then your other senses start to cease. Your hearing starts to disappear slowly and you become more centered inside of yourself. And your body starts to fade away as well. You don't really notice anymore that you've got a body. You're just sitting there, not being aware of your meditation object, maybe your breath or whatever else, your metta, or just the silence. And then even those experiences start to become more simple and disappear. The breath itself starts off quite coarse, like in, out, but slowly it starts to simplify. And even at some point you can't tell really anymore, is this in or out? And you even forget that it is breathing. You're just aware of this feeling. It starts to also simplify and disappear, change into a more subtle mental experience of the breath. At first, the breath is more like a physical sensation, but it starts to shift and become this mental reflection of the breath. I think it's called Citta Sankhara in the suttas, in the Anapanasati Sutta. This is when the breath becomes much more subtle and a bit more like a mental image. So then the whole body starts to disappear and you're just with the mind. And then the mind, you still have this sense of being able to control what goes on inside of your mind. You have the idea that if you want to stop meditating at any point, you can stop whenever you want. You still got the idea that if you wanted to think, you could think if you want. This is this illusion of will. It also starts to disappear. And when that starts to disappear and your mind goes inside, then that's when things really become hard to describe. And words don't really reflect what goes on. But whenever you have an experience like that, always reflect upon what has ceased, what has disappeared. And when your meditation goes really deep and you come out and you ask yourself, what has disappeared? This is also what the Buddha also, in the Anapanasati Sutta, for those familiar with that, the Sutta on the Mindfulness of the Breath, and there is, at the end of the instructions, there's a set of instructions where the Buddha instructs us to reflect upon cessation, reflect upon what has faded away, on vanishing. That is what the Buddha asks us to reflect upon. And then you will find that what has faded away, your sense of self, you have faded away. The whole ownership has faded away. The core of your being has vanished for a moment. If your meditation gets really, really deep, whatever you thought, you always thought you were, that has disappeared. And there was nothing really solid inside anymore. No essence. The Buddha compared it to like a water bubble. It seems like something, but inside it's just empty and hollow. And there is nothing there. There's nothing. That's what this talk is about. Nothing inside of a water bubble. And the same with inside of you. When you go deep in meditation, you'll realize there's nothing there. That's my name is Sunyo, means empty, because I took that because I'm so inspired by this concept. That's why I had that name. Emptiness inside. And when you realize from a meditation like real deep that there is no solid core inside, no essence, no self inside, then you realize there's nothing you need to hold on to. And that is just such a relief. Nothing that you need to take care of, nothing you need to protect, nothing that needs saving, nothing you need to worry about, because there's nothing inside of you anyway. You realize that. And you're really willing to let go more deeply, then you also realize that just the awareness itself has no solidity to it. And awareness itself is just a process and just a part of nature and nothing that will last forever. Awareness is not something that can exist forever, unity with God or as the permanent consciousness or whatever. You realize this is all impossible because there is no core inside of awareness. It's just an empty phenomena process. And then you, if you're like that, you realize, just like Hans, how happy it is to be able to give up on all of that stuff. Yeah. Other people, they struggle for a lump of gold, but you are much more wiser and you just go for nothing, go for broke. That is what my advice is to you. And this is all very deep, maybe. And for my first Dhamma talk here for the PSV, maybe you thought I should have started something less deep. But anyway, I was asked to talk about nothing, so that's what he got, nothing. And I hope this is inspiring to some of you. And if not, maybe focus also on other Buddhist ideas. Yeah, it's not all about nothing. Yeah, it's also a lot about kindness and love and generosity and making the world a better place and all these lovely concepts as well. So if you feel like the idea of nothing is a bit too challenging for you, then maybe it's not the right time yet. And then just focus on all these other lovely ideas that we have in Buddhism and brighten up your mind through those. And then maybe one day you're ready and you reflect upon the concept of emptiness and nothingness again, and maybe then you'll find it more inspiring. Yeah, it's no use to think about these things when it's not inspiring to you. Then it's not the right time. But anyway, I hope it was useful to at least to some of you. And I think I'll leave it at that. And then, there's should be maybe some questions. There's still some time for questions as well.
Thank you, Venerable, for the inspiring talk on nothing.
you asked for it.
Yes, I did. Thank you. Okay, we do have two questions so far. May I ask the first one? Monday, you told us about how you felt when you first connected and realized the profoundness of the Four Noble Truths. What did you feel when you first read of the Bahia Sutta? That's from Udana 1.10.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say I recognized the full profoundness of the Four Noble Truths the first time I read them. I just realized them on an intellectual level. I realized how different they were from other religions, and that it was quite unique. And I could really appreciate the Four Noble Truths. Other religions, I always had this idea they were mainly just comforting people, or I talked about that before, but Buddhism, I thought, was unique and had this really challenging concept, really challenging goal as well. And I really could see something in that, at least on intellectual level, and something I could appreciate about that. The Bahia Sutta, when I first read that, was many, many years later, because when I first read the Four Noble Truths, I appreciated it on an intellectual level, but I still wasn't really interested in really deeper Buddhism or what. I was just reading a little bit about what it was all about, but my deeper interest came much later, and that's when I started reading the suttas. And the Bahia Sutta, yeah, I really like it. I did not have the same kind of initial reaction to it, like, oh, this is something different, because I already was introduced to the concept of already before. In the suttas, there's so many suttas, there's thousands of suttas, literally, and if you put all the books together, they are, well, you'd be like Hans trying to carry it all. That's how many suttas it is, more than just one lump of gold. But there's so many, but the concepts in them are all repeated every time. So if you read, for example, the sutta on non-self, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, this is the second sermon by the Buddha, then that is, in essence, is nothing different from the Bahia Sutta. The Bahia Sutta is some I feel sometimes has this elevated status above other suttas in a sense. People seem to be drawn to it more because the story goes that this Bahia got enlightened really, really quickly after hearing this his story. Like, what was the exact instructions again? Like, then Bahia walked up to the Buddha and said, "Give me a very short teaching. I don't have too much time."
In the scene will be merrily the scene. In the hurt will be merrily the hurt. In the thought will be merrily the thought. In the known will be merrily the known.
Yes, yes. So yeah, in the scene, just the scene. In the hurt, just the hurt. In the what you think, just the thinking. And in the whatever you conscious, just the conscious. Basically means. In the scene, just the scene means no seer, just the scene. So as I said, no essence inside. It's just a process. I've used the word process before, a natural process. In the heard, it's just the heard, the hearing, the sense of hearing is just a process. It's just part of nature. And there is no hearer, no like soul inside, no being inside that receives the sounds or the sights, or that in the thought, just the thought, you think you are the thinker of your thoughts. That's what it feels like you do your thoughts. Sometimes you meditate and you step back from doing the thinking, but you feel still like you are receiving the thoughts as if they come to you. But both are illusions. Yeah. Both doing the thoughts and receiving the thoughts, if you think about thinking like that, they are both delusions, both wrong perceptions. Because there is neither a doer nor an experiencer of the thoughts. Both of these things are, the mind makes up as illusions. There's many meditation teachings I know throughout the world, and there are many of them, they stop and have as their highest goal something that is still very superficial in reality in Buddhist sense. So many meditation teachers, they teach you about thinking, about not being the actor of your thoughts, but instead stepping back and just letting the thoughts be, and just being at the receiving end of the thoughts and being there as the awareness behind the thoughts. And this is a very good and very nice teaching, but it stops at way too quickly. I mean, it doesn't go deep enough, because even just being the receiver of the thoughts, the one who is aware of the thoughts, if you think that's what you are, then that is also wrong. So this is why the Buddha said to Bahia, in the thought, just the thought. No thinker or no receiver of the thinking, there's just thoughts, that's all. And then the last one, which is the and this is the deepest one, vinyayate vinyayatang bhavisati, or something like that. I'm trying to recall the Pali because it inspires me personally, but forget about the Pali. The idea is, in consciousness, in what is conscious of is just the consciousness. No self inside that is conscious. No permanent citta, or no true being inside that is conscious. It's just consciousness. That's all. And consciousness is just a process. That is just like the wind. Sometimes it's the wind blows, and sometimes not. But the wind, does it have a core inside of it? Does it have an essence inside of it? No, the wind is just an empty. The wind exists, all right. But it's not, there's nothing you can show here, this is wind. Yeah, this is the essence of wind. No, wind is just a name we give to a process of that is that comes and goes, really, which has no fundamental entity to it. And this is the same with our whole experience, our whole life of consciousness. It's also empty inside. So yeah, that is what the Bahia Sutta tells us. And yeah, at times that has really inspired me. And I can't remember why I can't just chant the Pali straight off my head, because I've seen it so often, read it so often. But when you give a talk and you're already in a certain mindset, and sometimes difficult to bring up these things that on the spot, but it has inspired me a lot. So it's also a very useful sutta to reflect upon. But yeah, if it's helpful to you, then use it. If it's not helpful, then as I said, there's many other suttas that which tell you essentially the same thing. And the Buddha's teachings are not, they don't require lots of knowledge of suttas. You just need to know a little bit, and then that's can be enough already, which is exactly the point also in Made in the Bahia Sutta. This person just gets very short teaching, and then the story goes that he then becomes enlightened just based on four sentences by the Buddha, basically. Well, a little bit more than four, but yeah, it continues on. In the seeing, the heard, the thought, consciousness, consciousness. And if you see things like that, empty process, then you won't be there. You won't be there. You won't be there. That's what the Buddha said. Tvangnati or something like that. You won't be there. And if you're not there, skip a few steps, then in the end, there is no here or there or in between. What does that mean? No here or there in between when you're not there? It all sounds very, very vague, but it's vague because it's a very short teaching. It's a summary. And it means you are not there. If you see that there is no essence inside of you, which my whole talk has been about, if you see there is nothing inside, you are not there, then you are not here, not there, or in between. What does that mean? It means, first of all, you don't identify with this life, and also there won't be a next life, because you realize it's just an empty process. So why would you keep maintaining an empty process? You realize, just like Hans, that it's much more peaceful to end up with nothing. And so then there is no craving for any other experiences or any other state of being. And then when the craving goes, as it says in the Third Noble Truth, there's no more fuel for rebirth, no more driving rebirth. So you won't be there in the next life either. You won't be in between, means you won't be in between this life and the next either. Of course, if you don't have a next life, then there won't be an in between this and the next life. So this Buddha, very short summary, telling you how to end rebirth by not identifying with things. And it's very nice that you bring up that sutta, because I realize what the Buddha said so well in just those couple phrases. It's what I have been struggling and striving to sort of explain you in very clumsy ways in an hour. And I realize I haven't done half as good a job as the Buddha. Not nearly even close. But so it's nice that, yeah, you bring up that sutta. But it does sort of, in a way, confirm that exactly what I've been saying. Well, I don't need confirmation from the sutta, but it's always nice when when people bring up a sutta that does not contradict what you've just been saying. That would have been funny. But so yeah, thank you. If there's any other questions, then
yes, you. There are three more questions on the
list.
Three
more. Okay, I have to be a bit quicker. Okay.
Yes.
Let's go.
Okay, this question is, I think, is a little bit personal. Bodhiana or Newbery? What do most monks prefer and why?
Wherever you are is the best. And I always say, when I close my eyes, it's all the same. I spent the time in various monasteries, this one, both in Jana and others in the Netherlands and in Australia. But whenever I close my eyes, they're all the same. So.
Thank you. This question, the next question, I personally want to ask the same question too. What made you interested on mastering Pali?
I wouldn't say mastering Pali. I far from mastered it. I just saw how I struggled just recalling the Bahia Sutta. But Pali. So Pali is the language of the Buddha's teachings. And why would you do interested in Pali? There is English as well. I've got here the Metta Sutta. I just chanted it in Pali, but we also got the English version. Yeah, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness, for those who know it. So why would you learn Pali? I thought the same. I thought, why would you learn Pali? I will just stick to the English. When I came to Bodhiyana Monastery, I never really was very good at languages in high school. Always sort of struggled to get possible grades. English was okay, but we also obligatory had French and German. I also did Latin. I was always very bad at it, so I thought, I'm not going to study Pali. And also, I came to a monastery not to study and stuff. I came to just meditate. Then I remember one morning after breakfast, Ajahn Brahm, I was washing my bowl or something. Ajahn Brahm just said something about Pali being good to study Pali, and how it helped him personally with his practice. And then I sort of decided, okay, I'll do it then. I'll study Pali. And at the time, Ajahn Brahmali was teaching Pali, Bodhiyana Monastery. And although initially I didn't want to go to his classes, then I decided, okay, if Ajahn Brahm said it was helpful for him, I'll just go and see what's up. And I realized, actually, not that difficult, Pali. I mean, yeah, learning another language is not easy, but it could have been worse, let me put it that way. And I started quickly realizing it is actually helpful for me personally to learn Pali, because, for example, when I've heard a Metta Sutta, and I could just do the English, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. But it's inspiring, not do the slightest thing that the wise would reprove. But when I read it in the Pali, and I know the meaning of the Pali, and I realize that this is what the Buddha said himself. Maybe the words, the accent I don't get right, maybe slightly different. We don't really know 100% how the Buddha sounded like, because it's so long time ago, but you get these texts and you know it's from the Buddha. It's so much more inspiring to me. A translation is always just a translation, and they can also be wrong. And this, for example, this actually has a slight mistake in it, this very sentence itself, actually, which is funny. It's just let them not do the wise thing that the wise would later reprove. I think the meaning is actually let them not do the slightest thing that others who are wise would reprove. Anyway, so that's also a thing about Pali. When you read Pali, you can see mistakes in translations as well. And then sometimes actually very significant things. Sometimes mistakes in translations can really change the meaning of a whole sutta. In this case, it doesn't really matter either way, but sometimes it does. And then it just, I kept doing the Pali because of those reasons. And now, for those who don't know, I've been teaching the Pali in Bodhinyana Monastery since I was a novice, actually, already. And 6 years. And it still inspires me to this day to read the Pali. So if you have the time and the capability to do it, it's worth it. But then again, you don't really need it, because in the end, all the insights don't come from reading suttas, but they come from the meditation. So many monks who don't study Pali at all, and they're not any less of a monk because of that, because they just decided differently. Instead of spending time to study Pali, they decide to spend more time on other aspects of the path of their practice, which is fine as well. So to each their own. Yeah.
Thank you. Now we have around 10 minutes and there are two questions.
Okay. 5 minutes each.
Yep.
Or less.
This question is about sleep. If wake up in the middle of the night with anxiousness, what do we do?
So that's exactly what I used to struggle with as a layperson. Sleeplessness because of anxiety and too much thinking. And what do you do? Well, I found out that at the moment when you are already anxious in bed and sort of thinking a lot, you can do meditation techniques like scanning your body, for example, but it's much more fruitful to have a general meditation practice in your life. Not just start working on the problem whenever it puts its head up. Like, don't start working on your anxiety and your thinking at the moment it is when you're lying in bed in the middle of night, but already be generally prepared by having a daily practice of meditation. When I was younger, I used to have this little corner in my room that do a little bit of meditation. Maybe not even every day back then, but just from now and then, just sit down and just relax and just be there and just enjoy the present moment and just focus on your breathing and don't try and achieve anything. All those great meditation teachings, just apply them, and then you just be generally more relaxed, generally be more happy, and then it will also be easier to fall asleep as well, because of that you're being already generally more at ease. That would be my main advice. But if you do meditate daily and still end up being anxious in bed, then also maybe a bit more physical activity throughout the day is helpful for falling asleep. And also, if you do lie in bed, you can do beforehand metta meditation, is what the Buddha advised. So yeah, I won't give you the whole instructions on metta meditation right now, because I'll end up missing lunch. This is not the most important thing, but also other people are also waiting and want lunch. So yeah, but look up metta meditation on the internet and try that before you go to sleep. The Buddha said it gives you nice sleep and nice dreams, and I find it's true. So try that as well.
Thank you. Okay, there's one last minute question just came in, but I'm not sure if we'll have time to answer that. According to the time, I'll ask the question earlier first. Why does one want recognition and acknowledgement for hard work? For me, I want that to get more money for my kids. Where does the desire to be more and do more come from?
I'm not sure if I 100% get the question. The desire to do more in work? Why you want to do more in work? I don't know why you want to do more work. That's something you really have to answer for yourself, I suppose. You want to do more work. Maybe you get a sense of achievement out of it. I've been talking this whole talk about achieving nothing. And one of the challenging thing about being a monk is that you don't get any achievements. You don't get any diplomas or no bonus at the end of the year or when you move up in the job? No raise? Yeah? Nothing like that. So no achievements. And it can be challenging because we get a sense of happiness out of achieving things and doing things. But you have to look for a different kind of happiness. The happiness of the opposite of letting go of things, as Ajahn Chah said. Meditate to let go of things, not to get things. So, but you can say not just meditation, but your whole life can focus on that as a Buddhist. Live life not to achieve things, but to let go of things. So let go of working too much as well. You always need to do some, of course. But if it gets excessive, then just reflect, am I doing this for my long-term happiness, or is it just a short-term sense of achievement, which is always very unsatisfying in the end. Yeah? The sense of achievement, you just have it for a little bit, but then it quickly fades away, and it's much more sustainable to focus instead on long-term happiness of spending more time with your family or spending more time spiritual practice instead of just working all the time. I hope that answers your question. I must admit I didn't fully understand what you were asking. So,
thank you. This is the last question. May I ask if nothingness relates to see or hear things as they are?
Yes, it definitely does. Because when you see things as they really are, which is the insight that really sets up the Buddhist path, the insight of stream entry, sotapanna, that is when you see things as they really are, that's when you see things as really empty. That's when you see that there is no there is no core inside of you that will live on forever. And there is just empty processes, empty nature, natural processes that do their own thing, regardless of quote you inside. Yeah, when you are not there, that's when suffering ends.
I just got a very, very last minute. This is really the final question, okay?
Okay.
Because it's related, and that's why I think we have time to answer. If you want to achieve nothing, why do monks study?
The real thing is that you don't want to achieve nothing. You get it anyway. Yeah. So it's you stop the wanting. So it's not about desire, as I said before. Even me deciding to become a monk, it feels like it wasn't really up to me. I just had to do it. And the same with this practice of the Buddhist path. Once you reach a certain point, it's not about you wanting to practice or not wanting to practice. It's not about you wanting nothing or not wanting nothing. It happens anyway. And so, therefore, you want to study Pali or not, you just do it anyway. Why did I do it? Because Ajahn Brahm told me to, and it's not in my control to decide whether or not. Because the process of Dhamma is much stronger than your own desires. And not everything you do comes from desire or wanting anyway. So study Pali just because, not really something you want or desire. Hope that makes some sense. I often get this kind of cheeky questions, but just from a sense of intellect in a sense. So.
Thank you, Bande Sunyo. I would like to remind everyone that Ajahn Brahm's 70th birthday is coming up in 6 days. So please check out the website, ajahnbrahm70th.org. And then also you can check out the Global Metta Meditation Retreat online that is starting today. And also we have a Monday guided meditation tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m.
Am
I right?
That's true. Yeah. So the Global Metta Meditation for that person who is trying to fall asleep. And I said, try metta meditation. Well, there you go. Follow the global metta thing and you'll get plenty of instructions, I'm pretty sure, on that. And then I'll see you, yeah, tomorrow. Do some meditation as well. Thank you, Venerable. Thank you, Chinta.